and bourbon. The last time we did this, we promised we weren't going to take a huge hiatus. I think we made it through about, I'm going to say three. I'm going to give us three episodes before we took a break. And that's coming up on today's Friday, 12/8/23. 3 years in February, this coming February, if you're keeping track at home. That being said,
Gotcha.
part of the reason, and I'll get into this, is a lot of things have changed. And Clinically Pressed has now turned nonprofit. I always had this idea of turning and having the Clinically Pressed co-op, which would be this little mini podcast network, but you kind of need more than two or three podcasts in it. So this is going to be number four we're going to throw into the mix, which is part of the reason for getting it started up as well. And also for the fact that we just haven't really done a good job of keeping up on any kind of regular basis. So we're going to use this as an excuse. So I think first, if we want to just go around and kind of say where everybody's at, what you're up to, then we'll do our whiskey slash drink rating, and then we've got a topic for the evening. So Andy, you go first.
What am I supposed
What's
to say?
new and happening?
Well, 3 years ago, I guess it would have been same spot. Still at University of Illinois, but officially a PhD candidate rather than a student. That's about the only update I can give.
That's a good one.
And I'm one step closer. Hoping to finish up and move on to a postdoc somewhere TBD. Coming here in June, hopefully.
Nice.
But yeah, not super much change, just still trying to be productive, still trying to work and contribute.
AJ.
I work right down the hall from Joel. We're in the sports medicine department, Mayo Clinic
Long
Health
time
System.
listener, first time participant.
Yeah, that's right. Joining the rotation. Still trying to do whatever research we can over there in Mayo Clinic. Still do quite a bit with EWL and their athletes over on campus when we can, and then certainly added the firefighters into the rotation. They've been a nice cohort to work with and done some cool projects with them, and hopefully just scratching the surface on other stuff with that department locally or others kind of across the region is the next step.
Yeah, and kind of as AJ alluded to, I moved out of the collegiate setting, now working in the sports medicine department, support an orthopedic surgeon, and then kind of make up my job on the other days as the day comes. Doing a lot of stuff with the firefighters, which is fun. They're a good group. Definitely makes you want to be a firefighter when you kind of work with them, as we've witnessed from several people that have helped us collect data. All of a sudden, there's an interest in the profession. Yeah, God, if it's been no, I guess if the last one was in 2021, we had our one kid, we have our second one now, who's 17 months old, 3 year old, so that's keeping life busy. But other than that, things are good, always good to catch up.
Yeah.
What we're drinking tonight, Andy. I think we
Yeah.
rated it on glasses, and we pretty much always came up with the same rating, but that's okay.
Whiskey's good, and that's
He's
all that
good.
matters. I'm lucky enough to have a very generous friend who loves to, his love language is gift giving. He has provided me a beautiful bottle of Blanton's. You can't go wrong. Very nice bottle. Maybe not as prestigious as people chase it down to be, but still a very good whiskey. I've never tried it, and that's why the bottle's almost gone.
When you share it with all your friends, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's 4.6 glasses.
4.6.
Smooth, sweet, and it's just beautiful whiskey.
AJ, you're not much of a whiskey guy, are you?
Crown is probably
Oh, Crown
my
Apple.
go-to. Yeah. But I'm drinking Bent Paddle tonight out of
Nice.
Duluth. I was just gonna ask, what's the scale out of 4.6
Out of five.
Five.
five? Okay, well, that's a really good rating, man.
Oh, it's a great whiskey.
Yeah, I would rate these probably around a four. I really like them.
They
They're a
do
good
some good
brewery out
stuff.
of there. Yeah, that's what I'm rocking tonight, Joel.
So I got, and it's all my nicer whiskeys seem to age because I choose to drink cheap stuff on the regular and then just hold on to other bottles and just like, it's like a scarcity effect, but I also enjoy like then sharing it when people do come over. So this Coach A from UWL actually brought back for me. It is a Door County single malt whiskey.
Had that.
It's very good, very mellow. I enjoy it. There's still a good amount left for several years of me not being at UWL. So solid, I'd say in that 4.5 range, right up there. A good one. You know, I think $40-ish a bottle, which I feel like if for me, that's like my sweet spot of like a good whiskey. Anything that starts getting way above 50, I don't know that I can tell the difference, you know, between a $35 bottle and a $40 bottle, unless it's something dramatic with how it's created or the profile. So yeah, it's a good one. I was going to bring out the Four Daughters, which now does whiskey, along with all their wine and everything else, but there was very little of that left. So we're going to save that for another day. So I can get a little bit of a replenishment on that one. So yes, and if we once we polish this off, we'll switch over to the cheaper stuff, which is usually a handle of Jim Beam from Sam's Club because it's cheap.
Good old Sam's ultimately Club.
Not that bad. Been there for me,
but ultimately not that bad. I don't mind it at all.
I still go with Doc's Uncle's recommendation and drink Old Forester out of a plastic bottle.
Nice. Yeah, they don't have it. I did try some Evan Williams, which is also not, I mean, again, I'm not a connoisseur. And when you're just wanting a decent pour, but you don't want to have it cost you $8 a glass.
Well, I don't recommend Mick Adams if you're looking for the cheap stuff. That used to be our camping whiskey. You get like a 175 of it for $10 and head up into the woods.
Yeah, just never terrible. Find your way back out.
I mean, you could probably grab the kerosene for the grill and it wouldn't taste any different than the whiskey. Ugh.
All right. So our topic we were going to talk about, which we'll have to come up with a creative title at some point. Maybe just do you even lift, bro? Some of it was a paper we were talking about offline, and then which was just kind of comparing a couple different types of training. We thought that might be kind of interesting just to kind of talk about what we've found out in our own workout careers and what works, what doesn't seem to work for us, and how that can apply to other people. But then also the idea of quote unquote muscle confusion, which always seems to pop up for every now and again. If correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like P90X was like the thing that introduced muscle confusion. That was like their big sales pitch back when that was huge and on the infomercials everywhere. So I don't know, AJ, you want to kind of give some of the background on what you kind of were seeing with it and kind of what brought the idea of the topic up?
Yeah, so the study that Joel referenced was a training study. I think it was 12 weeks in which they were looking to see how two different training styles could influence kind of training adaptations over the course of that training program. And so they split up two groups. One did 3 days a week of kind of a full body split, and the other group just did 2 days a week. No, let's see, how many days a week did they do? The other one did more of a bro split. So they're just hammering body parts.
It was 4 days. It was like 2 to 4.
And yeah.
Ultimately equated for sets and reps.
Yep, that's right. So 4 days a week doing a bro split. I think they did upper and lower body. Yep. And then the other 2 days a week group just did a full body workout twice a week. And then the important detail there, as Joel mentioned, is they equated volume across the two different training groups, which if we look at, you know, some of the things that influence muscle growth in particular, it's volume throughout the week. So what this study kind of found that it doesn't really matter how you're getting your volume, whether it's in 2 days or if you disperse it over 4 days, as long as you're targeting similar body parts or muscle groups equally in terms of the dose or the volume that you're applying there, you should see similar adaptations over the 12 weeks. And that's kind of exactly what they found with that study. And the thing that I did a research review on it, and the thing that I liked about it is that you could literally just take that then and kind of adapt it to whatever your life schedule is, you know, for that particular point in the year or however you're kind of going about training. So if you only have 2 days a week to lift, fine, as long as you get enough volume in those 2 days. And then the other thing too is the time part. They didn't mention this in the paper, but I gotta imagine that the full body workout that they did had to at least have been an hour, maybe an hour and a half. Like there are a lot of exercises. And so you're gonna be in the gym longer or wherever you're lifting, whereas the other, you know, training sessions you could probably knock out in 30 minutes if you really wanted to. And so that's something that I've switched to recently in lifting is literally sometimes even like a 20-minute lift, just a couple body parts, but that's all I really have time for in the day, whether it's in the morning or at night or whatever, in between taking the kids around town. And I just find myself being more compliant by doing it that way. Otherwise, I would always do the, oh, I don't have an hour to get to the gym to shower afterwards. Like it's more or less 2 hours that you got to find. I just didn't have those big blocks of time anymore. Whereas carving off little 20, 30, maybe a 40-minute, you know, workout slot was just easier to kind of consistently do for me. So that's what I resonated with when I read that. It was just kind of nice to see that played out in the literature a bit.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And that's something I've tried to figure out. Like we were talking today when we were coming up with the idea, like 9 to 10, 12 at the most, like movements in a workout is basically all I get in before something's going on or a kid was waking up or, you know, it's the end of the day and I just don't want to do anything anymore. I even tried to mess around with that a little bit back when I was doing more of the programming Andy had sent me as not knowing what the morning was going to be, because even if I started working out every morning at 5, sometimes the kid doesn't wake up till 7. Sometimes the kid wakes up at 5:15. And so, like, if I could at least get like the big movement in of that day, you know, bench, the squat, or the deadlift, at least I was getting something done, and it was more of the compound. It's not like I just went down there and was able to get 3 sets of curls in and call it a day. But definitely trying to figure out like in my little home gym, what little tri set I can do, or you know, just kind of try a super set to use as much equipment as I can, but still hit as many body parts without fatiguing out. I meant to screw around with the 1x20 program, and did like one, and then rethought my life because I thought I was going to die after several things. So I need to revamp that and get a little less ambitious from the beginning, but it is one. That I'm thinking about trying again, just basic concept of you pick, I think you're supposed to try and get upwards of 15 exercises in is the goal, but you do one set, 20 reps, and even at lighter weight, you hit 13, 14, and things start to fatigue pretty hard. So it is not easy, especially on big movements, to get to 20, yet still use a weight that you think you should be using. I think they were recommending kind of about 60% potentially of your max. And I tried doing it on squat and that sucked. It was not fun. So we're gonna retool that one a little bit and maybe start with a little less ego and see what happens. But I'd be curious how that one truly goes. But again, something, you know, when you talk total body, you can hit a lot of muscle groups when you just got to do 20 reps, if you can keep going through it. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I know like some of that again comes down to the training goal specifically. Like Andy, do you think that like matching volume and stuff like that is the same for the strength and power world is for just more of the bodybuilding style?
Okay, sorry. I didn't realize my mic was muted. ask that again one more time.
So, like, you know, equating volume from one workout style to the next is really the most important variable there. And again, you can disperse that volume really however you want throughout the week for muscle growth. But in terms of like strength and power, would you say it's a similar type of situation or a little bit different?
So, I mean, it's probably a little bit different, especially in terms of like maximal strength of power. When we get into that realm, a lot of times it's kind of a practice issue, right? So like, sure, you can get stronger by doing a lighter weight for a lot of repetitions, but you don't quite get the same probably neural adaptations. Like you don't get the same synchronicity, probably the same activation, but more importantly, you don't get exposed to that, right? So if you take somebody who does say sets of 20 every day on back squat and try to make them max out on back squat, they're probably not going to get or take that too well. And if all you do for the next week is just have them max out every day, you're going to see an increase because they get exposed to those heavier repetitions more. They get exposed to that specific activity. But that's not to say that that really matters. Unless you're a competitive powerlifter, or certainly like gym goers, it's nice to have a systematic approach to assessing the effectiveness or efficacy of your training. So certainly you can kind of go about a training program where you max out. But at the end of the day, repetition maxes are fine, unless for some reason you really enjoy the one RMs, or like I said, you're a powerlifter. And along those lines, I think for muscular power, it's got to be the same thing. Because if you don't go about explosive or rapid contractions very often, I just can't foresee you're going to have the same adaptation. But there are one paper pops to mind along that line. It was, who was it? It was DB Sale and David Bem, I think. And it's a really interesting finding that I don't think anyone's really followed up on until, I mean, they're kind of tiptoeing around it now with the actual movement speed or velocity versus the intended. What they did is isometric type work versus isokinetic type work. What they found after a period of training, I forget how long it was, I haven't read this paper for probably since TCU, so for 4 years maybe. But what they found is even if you don't have the movement velocity in actual practice, so say you intend to do a very explosive leg extension, but it's against a dynamometer that's not going to move. If you intend to activate that way and do an explosive one, the adaptations match exercise where you move in that way, where you have the free actual motion, which kind of makes sense if you think about it. Like I said, I haven't seen any follow-ups on it, but why would actually moving really matter? Whether you move or not, the muscular contraction, I guess I go back.
Yeah, but you're not getting any of that stretch shortening cycle response that I would think would be needed there.
Yeah, but think about like a leg extension. There's no stretch shortening cycle.
For that
you just
movement,
have
yeah.
A very high, like a very rapid release of calcium. You have the very high activation because you get a really large descending signal to the muscle, right? All the things are there, whether you move or not. And I think that'd be a really interesting kind of place to explore that I don't think a lot of people have.
Kind of reminds me of the cross training or cross education type concept, you know, where like you just train unilaterally and you actually can see adaptations on the other, you know, side. I just think those things are so cool that, to your point again, like the muscle's not even moving, not even contracting in that situation, but you still get that kind of neuromuscular crossover that seems to still be able to play a role in the unused limb.
Yeah,
We
but
try to use that a
certainly.
lot in rehab as like no excuse not to do anything.
I mean,
Just continuing to do stuff.
that's all I've been doing in my garage gym since the accident. Can't use that the right arm, so I've just been hammering away on the left side, doing whatever I can think of for exercises.
But certainly with the change in muscle size and kind of growth, yeah, I think it goes to exactly two really important points I think you guys brought up. What can you do regularly? Like as soon as you guys started talking, the first thing that popped in my head is don't let perfect be the enemy of good. What can you maintain to not let yourself skip out on a workout for all the reasons you brought up? Well, I have to go to the gym and I wouldn't have that much time and yada yada yada. And also another really good point is what do you enjoy?
The
And I
best
think,
workout is the one you actually do,
yeah, 100%.
100%. Or the one that you can actually stick to.
I think going to that, the only part of muscle confusion that I think is valid is if you get bored and if the same type of stuff every day gets stale for you and it means you're not going to try and not have fun and put effort in, yeah, change it up every day. It doesn't matter. There's nothing special about it, but if that's what'll make you enjoy it and kind of bust ass in the gym, do it.
Well, and I think that's why it became so popular is because people craved that. I need something new and exciting to keep me motivated to do stuff. They just didn't like sitting down and hammer away at the same workout every week and get better at it. So, Joel, you were saying with the P90X, like that's why that thing blew up so much is it were fun, exciting, challenging workouts, something different every day. You never knew what you were gonna get.
Just like we were talking, if somebody's just starting out, like you can get a lot of strength changes by doing the same thing for quite a period of time. If you just progress your reps up, and then if those, you tap out there, you start progressing a little bit of weight, like you can potentially go for quite a while. I almost wonder if that's, again, muscles don't think, muscle confusion, whatever you take out of it. Do you get almost like a dual effect with that? Is because you're changing things up, like you just feel like you can get those progressive things, but you're just getting that much better because you are doing different things. You're recovering a little bit from doing one style, one day versus another one. I always bicep curl. Like if I'm doing a traditional bicep curl on Monday, but doing a hammer curl on Thursday, and then when I come back for the bicep curl the next Monday, like both of those increase over time because yes, they're similar, but they're working slightly different muscles and how they're doing it. So that's why you're getting all these results by quote unquote muscle confusion when you're really just following some more like progressive overload. You just happen to be hitting more things. Not to
Well, I
say that
think
you
that.
have to do that.
Well, I think that's. I mean, when you get down into more of the technical side of the muscle confusion concept, like again, if you're changing exercise types or grips or angle, like you're going to be recruiting slightly different, muscle fibers and being used in different ways. So you'll still expand kind of the, I think, adaptations that you could get because of that. Like there are alterations from one movement to the next, even though they're targeting the same muscle group per se, but there's going to be some, slight differences every time. And I
And
think
I
people
think,
also like that soreness that they get, from the novelty of a new exercise. Like, oh, must have really worked it yesterday. I'm sore. I did something different.
yeah, I think one other thing is the volume aspect, right? Like if you're doing, I don't know why we keep using bicep curl, but it is, I guess, an isolated movement that's easy to picture. But any other exercise, like if you're still doing your bicep curls and then you keep changing up all of the accessory movements you're doing, you're likely to be able to do more volume, and that volume is going to push you to adapt more. And another aspect that it's something I've learned a lot about, because it was huge for me, is the psychological aspect. sometimes just seeing or doing a new exercise where maybe you haven't done in a while, there's an infinite number of exercises you can do and see a PR, right? And sometimes just that PR, and even if it's something trivial like pull downs, I've never done 185, I've only done 170, and you hit a PR on pull downs, like that can change the dynamic of your workout and make you try harder on other things, which then facilitates kind of augmented progress in other things, right?
Yeah. I
And I
even
think
feel that
that.
way just stepping in a new gym, like, oh man, this is sweet. I've never tried this machine before. And just the excitement of being in a new atmosphere alone can sometimes just jumpstart a workout like that.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people leave that by the wayside. Kind of like I think people have realized the placebo effect is still a valuable tool.
Heck
I
yeah.
think the psychology can't be left out because it will build or destroy a workout or a competition or a training cycle. And so sometimes, yeah, just do something you haven't done in a while, get a PR. And let that kind of motivate you to continue in the gym that day.
Andy, you were talking about before we again when we before we came on and recorded something with satellite cells and like muscle memory to a degree. And I'll let you explain it, but I just know I it was basically the concept of like, say you had really good training, life changes, things came up. If you're an athlete or just generally into working out or any type of competitor, you get injured, and things slow down a little bit for you. The ability to get that back when you've already reached a certain point versus, continuing to try and excel on that point, because that's one I always talked with a lot of, especially when I worked with football, of like, yeah, we're going to lose some, but you've already set a high bar. It's going to be easier for us to get back there than it was for you to get there because your body's already been there. So I get it. We're going to get there, but let's not overly stress about it because it will get back.
Yeah.
You said you just had seen some more interesting things coming out of that, which I'd just be interested to hear more about.
100%. Well, I guess preemption, I'm not a molecular biologist, and nor do I
You're much
have
closer than
the
I am, so I'll take it.
But I
and we're
play one
both
on TV. Is that where you're getting
yeah,
at?
infinitely far away. But I can read a scientific paper and try to understand it. Some of this work is way over my head, but from my understanding, which is all I can speak about, yeah, there's work coming out and work that's been done for a while, unlike this idea of like myogenic memory. And I think there's some data suggesting that that's facilitated through either satellite cell characteristics or satellite cell number. Whereby, yeah, if you train and your satellite cells adapt in some way, like I said, whether it's some intrinsic characteristic or the tool number, the location, whatever it is, and if you stop training and detrain for a while, it seems like there's some pathway whereby if you start training again, you get to where you were. Even relative, if you went to near to where you started training, much faster than you would if you had just started training. So basically, you get back to where you were appreciably faster than how long it took you to get there. And I think anyone who's trained and taken time off understands this just viscerally. I don't think it's just satellite cells, but you come back and feel really bad about yourself for a little while, but after 2, 3 weeks of kind of banging in the gym, you're close to where you were and you feel just as comfortable as you were.
It's such a good feeling to know that it can come back and come back that quickly. Like, because as it's going downhill, you just get pissed. You're like, God dang it, I worked so hard. to accrue a certain level of strength or size, and then you just watch it go right down the toilet. But you try to remind yourself and come back pretty quick. Body is surprisingly adaptable.
Thanks. There's a paper, I think Stu had a paper, Stu Phillips at McMaster in Cell, kind of discussing this idea. It was a review, I believe, or a secondary analysis of some stuff. And I could just be misremembering because I had just read way more papers in the past month than I have in a long time. That would be a good thing to pull up and maybe put in the show notes.
There's another one too that I used to teach off of in class, of a really well done study. It was a training study, and then they had like a detraining group and a complete cessation of training group, and then evaluated like how low the decreases in strength and size got, and then they kind of restarted the programs and followed them up after 4 weeks. I think they had three conditions actually. One that kept going, one that detrained, like just cut things in half, the other one that completely stopped. And, you know, all three,
yeah,
after that, like 4 weeks, you know, actually but, still had similar. I got you. I can hear you. Now you're frozen.
Thankful for editing.
Yeah, good point. I think Esquierdo was the author on the paper I'm thinking of.
Yeah, if you get them, send them along. If you remember it.
Yep, I'll track it down.
Now you're on mute.
Yeah, I have no idea what's going on with my internet, but I pay way too much for this.
Yeah, we feel that here too. Yeah, for both of those articles, if you guys could send them along, I'll link them up in show notes. I know from own personal experience, it's been the way that I've steadily crept myself towards 300 pounds. Is I'll start lifting heavy, get in a good place, put on some muscle, life will happen. I won't work out, yet somehow my weight doesn't seem to drop with that. And then I start up again, and so all of a sudden I'm up 10 more pounds unintentionally. So you got to be careful if you do detrain, that you got to watch how you handle some of that stuff, because that has been how I've grown considerably since I graduated college.
Well, I think along that line, I don't think this is the direction any of us were meaning to go, but I think it's important if life comes up to still try to do whatever you can. So it's the idea for of sure. Exercise snacks, trying to do whatever you can. I tell my mom this, right? If you don't have the desire to go to the gym, just try to move more. So when you get home from work, stand up and sit down in your chair 10 times, wait 20 minutes and do it again. Try to break up sedentary time by going for a walk, even 5-10 minute walk, get up and stretch, whatever. More is better. And there is an upper limit that I don't think anyone in their right mind, there are people who go above that upper limit, but most all regular people probably are not even close to approaching of the volume that you'd have to worry about.
Yeah.
And I think just walk. Going for a walk for 10 minutes when I think especially in professions like academia and research and being in a clinic, maybe athletic training might be a little bit different because you're up and doing exams and kind of treating and whatever. But certainly in academia, we get stuck at desks behind computers quite a bit. And if you can do the standing desk, great. If you can't, then just get up and go for a walk, go grab a water, go to the whatever. 5-10 minutes, try to break up the sedentary time. I think there are enough data and they're very convincing. Even Stu had that study where they had people just stand up and sit down, and they found greater cumulative muscle protein synthesis over the course of a day. I think breaking up sedentary time, I mean, not even, I find instead of when I get that urge at like 1 o'clock or noon to grab a coffee, a lot of times I just go for a 15-minute walk, and it's way more effective than just pounding more caffeine that ultimately just makes me feel worse.
Yeah, I've even done that exercise snack concept with like strength workouts, usually on like lighter load days. Because the thing I like about that is that I skip warm-ups. Like very rarely will I go through a 20-minute, you know, warm-up. Unless I'm working up to like heavy singles or doubles, you know, you kind of progress your way up to it. But like I'll literally, there's mornings like Joel's saying like, oh, I'm going to get a workout in before the kids get up. You're like three lifts in and all of a sudden kids are up. It's like, well, I only got a third of the way through my workout for the day. But then I'll like, after we get ready, we got 15 minutes before the bus comes, I'll do just two more exercises. Yeah. And then at night, like same thing, like, we got a little time while dinner's getting made. I'll go do the last two lifts of the day. And throughout the day, I got my workout in, but it certainly took multiple attempts. And again, like without having to do warm-ups and stuff like that, because the loads were lighter, you're able to do that. And I think it's just a better way instead of, oh, I don't have time to go to the gym for an hour and 20 minutes today. Like if you have that mentality, I'd rarely get the amount of workouts in that I want to. And then I'm also spoiled by having a garage gym. Like, obviously, yeah, that's not very feasible for everyone if they have to physically go to a gym to get stuff in. But
I mean, I do have a cyclist too, or not a cyclist, concept too in my living room.
Nice.
So, there you go. We started telling the kids, like, we got a treadmill and a bike out in the garage. Like, if they want to watch more TV, then we're, you know, comfortable letting them do or something. We'll say, all right, you can keep watching, but you got to go out and walk on the treadmill while you watch your show or whatever. So we're trying to dangle that carrot in front of them.
I think it would be a really interesting thing. You met Max at ACSM. Joel, you haven't. Yep. In our lab, we have, I still think he's nuts, but he was director of sport nutrition for Notre Dame Athletics. Okay. And then started, so he's RD, CSSD, and just decided to change it up and get a PhD. But he is, I don't want to say nice things about him if he ever sees this. He is probably one, the person that epitomizes this idea so much. Half the time you can't find the guy because he's just pacing around in our big gym space in Freer and answering emails on his phone, or he's walking on the treadmill typing and reading or whatever. He can't sit still. And I mean, it shows. Super fit dude, jacked. I mean, pretty ugly, but he would be an interesting, especially because he RD, CSSD, has the athletics background and kind of the transition. I think he would be an interesting guest to have on here.
Yeah.
Talk about this and a range of topics, obviously.
Not to totally veer off our point, but that was kind of one of the styles we were thinking about doing with this. As we set this time, we just invite people to join, give them the basic premise, and just have a few more guests instead of just a couple of people yakking at each other. So hopefully, you know, if we get a streak going again, don't call it a comeback, but we can see if we can get that actually going.
Well, he owes me an interview anyway, because he volunteered to write an article for CPFDA. Is that the organization?
Yep.
Yep. And forced me to do a written interview. So I'll chat with him and see if he's willing to come on.
That's a conference I'd really like to get to. I've heard those are good events. It's just always
every year.
It's always like 2 weeks before ACSM. That's why I've never done it, because it's, I don't think I could swing both those trips almost back to back. But
should go to ASM last year.
Where's that one at?
Chicago.
Oh yeah. See, I was gonna say that the reason why I should have gone to CPSDA last year is because it was in Minneapolis. Yeah, it was right up the road.
Yeah.
Tinsley was talking at it.
But yeah, not to veer in personal conversation on a podcast that Not to brag, but we had 139 listeners on. I
Kind
think
of a big deal.
that's a big one.
It's this prevailing idea with both exercise, nutrition, everything, right? Change is hard, and doing things that are beneficial typically aren't that fun unless you're maniacs like probably most of our friends who really enjoy beating the hell out of themselves in the gym. I think incremental progress is still progress, and I think people underestimate like exactly going back all the way to one of the, I forget which one you said it. One day a week, huge. It's infinitely better than 0 days a week.
And you can maintain a lot with one day a week. You may not
And
be
you
getting
can
gains, but
progress.
you, yeah, it may not be
100%
as
you
much as
can.
you want, but you can definitely hold on to where you're at.
And I think this is good timing for this because AHA just finally has come out and said resistance exercise is good for the cardiovascular system.
Yeah, you just lift the weight
Vascular.
faster,
Fake
right?
news. That's not real.
Yeah.
Cardio,
It's,
you mean lifting the weights faster?
I think that would be, God, I might have to send you two papers, I think.
Send them.
Did AJ, did you read Stu's commentary on the age of resistance exercise for health?
Is that the one that has like dosing recommendations in it?
It was in,
It's a big journal, wasn't it?
let me pull it up.
I think one of our former Lindenwood students was on that. I think I know which one you're talking about.
He didn't publish so much. Dang it, Sue.
He's got to have an H index off the charts.
Oh, well, I'm on this. What does it say here? Oh, yeah, like 135 based on Google Scholar. Yeah, I'll pull it up. I'm not gonna waste time here, but I think previously everyone would basically had the idea that resistance exercise was bad for cardiovascular health. And I think it got a bad rap, but certainly I think it's, if it's good for cardiovascular health, that's great. Even if it's not, I think it's good for functional capacity and functional independence, which means you're not frail, which is the biggest predictor of all-cause mortality. The ability to take care of yourself is huge, both physically and psychologically. Lift weights and drink whiskey.
This seems
I
like a
mean,
good time for a shameless plug for our new CP clothing store that we just opened up officially today, with one of our first shirts having the quote, "I work out because I enjoy pizza and beer" on it. Just telling it how it is. So by the time this is out and you're listening to this, head over to clinicallyfresh.org/shop for a link to that. More shirts coming in the future. We're just getting a few of them. The other one, Andy, I would guess you would probably agree with is, it says squatting isn't bad for your knees. So
it's great for your knees.
check those out if we get anything resembling 139 listeners to this episode.
I wonder where that concept did originate from, though, Andy, of lifting being bad for, like endurance or cardiovascular health. Because it
I
wasn't
think
it like
there's
the specific
certainly,
hypertrophy of the heart, like.
yeah, I think it's, I mean, there's certainly some evidence indicating that concentric hypertrophy, like concentric left ventricular hypertrophy, probably not the best thing in the world. I think the evidence is strong enough to say that it's bad. And so this is the idea that your heart has to pump harder because the systemic blood pressure is so high that in order to eject blood into the aorta and systemic circulation, it has to contract harder. Whereas eccentric left ventricular hypertrophy is probably very good, which is you're running, so you have a lot more venous return, a lot more filling of the left ventricle, and that stretching causes hypertrophy. I think the basis is probably good, but I mean, there are goods and bads to even for muscular health, resistance exercise, right? Like, so I think it's more about not picking the individual characteristics that change, but looking at a holistic adaptation or a holistic adaptive response.
I was gonna
I would
say, because
imagine.
you know, if you just get outside of the heart, like you're gonna see a ton of improvements in vascular function, vascular health. You know, you're gonna see the metabolic improvements. You're gonna see improvements in VO2 max, like if you want to stay within the endurance side of it. And so, like, there are a lot of other positives that often get overlooked in that kind of topic. But I guess, yeah, if you're just focusing on the heart, I could see that kind of.
And I also think a lot of people think about cardiovascular health and kind of muscle health within the paradigm of an athlete. And I think that's a flawed idea, that I understand why. I typically think of it that way because I come from an applied sports science background and I've been an athlete most of my life. But I think when you really honing on like the general population and just a recreationally active person who's lifting weights and running to try to be healthy, I think there's very little you could say that resistance exercise is negative. I think it's contribution. Everyone thinks about the physical side, right? The strength power paradigm, being able to be functionally independent, but its contribution to regulation of whole body metabolism can't be understated. It's a central site for glucose disposal. It's important for fatty acid disposal and regulation. It's the only reservoir, not the only, liver too, the primary reservoir of amino acids.
And see,
And
that's where I think it's better than endurance exercise in that regard, like with all those types of benefits.
yeah, I think we should be careful about cautioning. I think we can be realistic, but the translational side, I think we should be careful about bringing up the dangers of something that is inherently good. I think education is one thing, but scaring people into not exercising who don't have a background in physiology and health and biomedical stuff, I think is a dangerous game.
Yeah. And like you said earlier in the episode, very few people are even coming close to that going overboard the threshold idea, you know, whether it's too heavy or too much volume. And even doing cardio stuff, like in terms of too many miles throughout the week, like very few people come close to that, even if your whoop strap says you're overstrained or whatever, you know, like. A lot of people don't even come close to half of what would probably actually be needed to be overtrained or going over that threshold.
Just move.
Agreed. Find what works, get after it, make it consistent, and then look at
Yep.
small changes that can have a big impact.
Don't make it more complicated than it needs to be.
Ain't that the truth? Complicated,
And
simple, right? A
be realistic.
lot of people are good at finding excuses and reasons why they can't work out consistently rather than finding excuses to work out consistently.
Yep, and we get it that there's a lot out there to consume, and that's kind of also part of this is, you know, you can just find something, go for it, start slow, get there. Jumping into full P90X or insanity right away might just be that, might be a little insanity, but you can br work your way up there if that's truly what you want to do. Or, as Andy was saying, you can go for a walk, work on picking up the pace. Find a route you like, and then just try and walk it a little faster the next time, and then a little faster, and then a little longer. Just keep on going.
Yeah, I think that's huge.
This is the first year I got my average daily step count for the entire year
Okay.
above
13.
13,000 steps a day.
Darn.
Yep.
Isn't that, I mean, I think it's so crazy. Americans, and I'm a fat guy, so I mean, I'm guilty of it. And I'm a fat PhD student candidate. So I'm behind a desk a lot, but I think the idea that people regularly get in America like less than 5,000 steps comparatively to developed European countries and particularly a lot of the Scandinavian countries, just getting 10,000 steps a day is probably, if I had to give one piece of health advice that was specific and measurable, it would mitigate a huge number of deaths in this country.
And it's embarrassing how hard it is sometimes to get there.
It's even
Like
when you
kind
look at
so much in the winter.
yes.
The summer when are the nicer months when the kids are out and want to go for a bike ride and you just go for a random walk because of that. Yeah. And then the winter where it's just hard to get outside. Yeah. Sometimes those steps are harder, but I get you.
One of the hardest, or not hardest, one of the most ridiculous realizations I had when I first started reading kind of endurance type training research is that I don't have to know where the IRB was that approved the study. I can just look if they're recreationally active and like general pop people. I can just look at the descriptive characteristics for VO2 max and know if it was done in the US or done somewhere else. Because in other countries, it's not abnormal to have a 45 average, whereas in the US, that's not going to happen for the vast majority of studies. 45, 50, even, depending whatever methodology you use to measure VO2 units. But
I remember reading in class, you know, like some people's graded exercise time duration, like they, you know, as long as they got in the test before they had to stop and reading, you know, some people only went like 4 minutes. I was like, what the hell? 4 minutes? Like, come on. And then I tested some people in our clinical weight loss trials. That same thing, they wouldn't even get out of like the warm up or stage one. And they're giving me the cut signal. I'm just like, whoa. And their VO2 max was 7 or 9, you
goodness.
know, and that's relative. That's not absolute
Yeah.
VO2. That's 9 mils per kg per minute. Just like, oof. That is deconditioned.
Move more.
Yep.
Well,
Well,
fellas.
I'm gonna be the one to call it. I'm exhausted.
I was gonna say, I feel like this is a good first step back. And like we said, we're gonna try and make this a streak. We'll try and do it on a day where we're all a little more lively instead of a Friday evening when everybody's pretty much ready to pack it in. But we wanted to do it. It was a good reason to start after Andy finished up comps and all of those exams to get on to dissertation. But I'm looking forward to this. I'm excited to get going again.
Yeah, me too. I think reconnecting with you guys is gonna be really good, and I think things are about to change for me, so you guys get to watch progress.
Yep. And we'll get some more
Right.
guests on. We got a few, you know, probably get Doc on, gotta get Kyle on, gotta get a few others. So, shit. Maybe over the holidays we'll do something if Andy gets back up here and we can all figure out a way to connect again. So,
Yeah, 100%.
let's just do again like a live stream while he's driving so we get 8.5 hour episode in.
There you go. Just it'll make the
I'm
time
in.
fly.
I call a million people anyway, so
There you go. Good way to get things done. Well,
yep.
fellas, enjoy the rest of your evening and we'll get this out because I was able to at least sort of get back into the Spotify, at least know what email it is so we can get it posted again. So
Go.
we'll go from there. And offline, we'll talk about at some point. We maybe have to do some apparel. We found a pretty slick way to do that. So we'll figure that out. But until next time, we'll talk to you guys later.
Sounds good.
Adios.